happy day.
Oh, happy day.
When Jesus wore.
When Jesus wore.
Oh, when he wore.
Live from New York City, it's the Gary Null Show. And now, your host, Gary Null.
Hi, everyone. I'm Gary Null. Nice to have you with us today. We're going to be talking about how antioxidant enzyme protects telomeres. And this is from a major university in science in France. Why is that important? Because the telomeres are what prevent you from aging prematurely. If they're shortened, you die faster. If they're lengthened, you live longer. So this is a big deal. Also from the New York State Institute for Basic Research in Developmental Disabilities, eating walnuts every day helps to find a way of helping people with Alzheimer's disease. And from Biotech Week, they're looking at synthetic and natural antioxidants to protect your brain. Are loneliness and health connected? The Cleveland Clinic. I'll give you the answer. And the late effect of stress. New insights into how the brain responds to trauma from earlier in life, even though in this moment you may not have trauma, the body's responding as if you did. And the Linus Pauling Heart Disease Prevention shows how vitamin C can allow your heart to be healthier longer. And I'm going to give more information on that, taking more time on that. New study confirms marijuana heals broken bones and prevents rejection of transplanted organs. That's important. And let's just say that you've traveled someplace, or maybe in a restaurant, you were eating from silverware that had not been sterilized, drank from a glass that was not sterilized. Maybe you were in a supermarket, and you saw a cherry or a strawberry, something that you could just pick up, and you ate one. 24 separate hands touched that. None of them were clean. A lot had feces. So what's the likelihood of you getting intestinal parasites? And if you do, what would I suggest will help you overcome parasites? How would you know if you have parasites? Well, how about bloating and constipation and gas? Those are just some, but there are more. Also today from our audio segments, we're going to take a look at how, quote, how to become a gluten intolerant, ultra-spiritual person by J.P. Sears. I think you'll find it amusing. And something won't amuse you, but it needs to be said. Someone finally stood up in the media, Jim Dore from the Young Turks, and he talked back to Barack Obama. Good. For all of the people, the many people living in Canada who are listening every day, you thought you were bringing into power Mr. Trudeau, whose family was looked upon as more liberal. Well, now we have a member of parliament who's standing up to Trudeau and the entire establishment and saying, hold on a second. You're wanting to defend Kinder Morgan, the company that's putting a gas pipeline across our territories, and you're allowing the army to be used against British Columbians who are protesting, no different than in North Dakota. So since we rarely hear about the protest of Canadians against their government for something that we're now still protesting in the United States, there's still about anywhere from 500 to 1,000 protesters out there. We'll play that for you. I think you'll find that important. Also, reasonable people will ask, I'm less interested in who's giving me the message than the veracity of the message. What is the information that you're giving me? That is what the American media has refused to do. We'll play that. I'm also going to leave time for talkbacking today, so you'll have a chance to call in. We're going to talk about how a whistleblower has exposed how NATO's leading ally is arming and funding ISIS. Shouldn't we pay attention to this? If we're really interested in getting rid of terrorism, why should we allow, with a wink and a nod, our allies to arm, protect, feed, train, and then defend ISIS terrorists? But that's what we're doing. Also, those of you who've been on the paleo diet and swear by it, well, archaeologists in Israel are saying, hold on, we're going to rewrite history because the ancient humans feasted on a wide variety of plants. 55 different species of plant foods were in the early diet. So we're going to look at that. And diabetes, heart disease, and back pain dominate U.S. healthcare spending. This is from the Institute of Health and Metrics and Evaluation. I'm going to give a commentary on that. So we have a lot to share. Let's begin. According to a research institute in France, published in the peer-reviewed journal Cell reports, they discovered that an antioxidant enzyme that protects the cell's telomeres, sequencing of repetitive nucleotides, which in turn cap and protect the chromosomes. Telomeres are especially vulnerable to damage caused by oxidative radicals, the byproducts of just normal metabolism. So let's just say, for example, you went out for a jog. Good for your body, bad for your aging. Why? Because it creates oxidative stress. That speeds up the degradation of telomeres. It shortens them. And yet, overall exercise, if you compensate by taking your antioxidants prior to going out for an exercise, like vitamin E, coenzyme Q10, vitamin C, tocotrienols, L-carnitine, all great for you, but then you get the benefit of the exercise and it doesn't speed up the telomeres. So it's important we understand how important these telomeres are. And what they're finding is that when you are incorporating more of the antioxidants into your diet, you're shortening this process towards disease. You're in other words, you're stopping disease and you're lengthening your life. So that's important. Quote, our study links oxidative damage and telomeres, both of which have been previously linked to aging and cancer. So eat a lot of fruits and vegetables, take your antioxidants, protect your telomeres, and live a longer life. And helping you live a longer life, according to this report, is having a handful of walnuts every day. This is New York State Institute for Basic Research. Eating a handful, quote, of walnuts per day may help reduce the risk, delay the onset, slow the progression, or prevent Alzheimer's disease due to the anti-inflammatory, antioxidative properties of the dry fruit. That's good. And so what is it about this? It's the oils, the quality of the phytonutrients mixed with the oils in the walnut. Of all the nuts that you could have that would be good for your brain, walnuts would be number one, but right behind those are almonds, then pistachios, pumpkin seeds, and sunflower seeds and hemp seeds. Those are the superstars, and that can help your brain. So eat walnuts, fight Alzheimer's. And if you have Alzheimer's, my suggestion is not to feed raw walnuts, but rather to put them in a blender with a teaspoon of coconut oil, and then put those two things together into a cereal. Now, there are several types of oatmeal And if there's one cereal most people could have without a whole lot of problems, it's oatmeal. But the question is, what is the best type of oatmeal? Well, we want to thank Michael Lewis, who did a little research, and he contacted Quaker Company. And they said that they are getting their product from farmers who may be using glyphosate. And that's why you should get the organic, always certified organic oatmeal. But then the best type of oatmeal to get is the steel coat oatmeal. It's going to be a little more expensive. It'll take longer to cook, but so what? And the best way of cooking oatmeal is you put it on a very low flame and you add your water and you stir it in, but then I add the following: cinnamon, pureed banana, sunflower, sesame, and pumpkin seed butter, which is simply the pumpkin seeds that have been pureed, that's all it is. And then some walnut butter. Then throw in some blueberries, raspberries, pomegranates. Put in a tablespoon of plant-based protein, like a split pea protein or a non-genetically engineered organic soy protein or rice protein. And you stir that all around. I like to add some apple juice. And it'll take about a total of 10 minutes because you're using a very low heat. And it'll be very gelatinous. But it's not gelatin. And even though there are a couple studies showing how gelatin might help joints, I'm opposed to that, and I'll tell you why. First, now that you have your steel-cut organic oatmeal and not your minute oatmeal, that's got beta-glucan, that's got high-quality phytonutrients, rich minerals, iron, magnesium, manganese, calcium. And what I just told you is the ultimate breakfast. You're getting all your protein, fat, essential fatty acids, phytonutrients, fruits in one simple meal. And you can have a cup, or most you should ever have is a bowl. You never have more than a bowl of food. That's why I believe in grazing, like a cup here, a cup there throughout the day. And the less food you put in bulk, the quicker it's digested, the more completely it's digested, the easier digestion, and the lighter you feel. There's one absolute in life. The less excessive calories you put in the body, the longer you're going to live. Calorie restriction is the ultimate way of helping lengthen the body. And 7 years before Professor Roy Warford got the credit for doing that, I already had done that research at the Institute of Applied Biology. In fact, I did 143 separate original studies. The reason most of them never got published is because the different department heads were ultra-orthodox, very obnoxious people who didn't believe in health. They didn't believe, and if they didn't believe in it, it couldn't get officially sent out. The only thing that some did, like the fact that I discovered that all plants have all eight essential amino acids, and therefore you never in your life have to eat anything that is an animal source to get your protein, that finally got out. But most of it didn't. But I was restricting calories in mice and having them live much, much longer and always leaner and healthier and happier. I didn't believe in cages. They had a whole environment they could run in, had more endurance, and never got bitten, by the way. That's what freaked a lot of people out. They come upstairs at night because I allowed people to come in and sit there watching me do the experiments. And we would talk, and they just were amazed that you could have 1,000 rats running around and never get bitten. In any case, there's now kind of a popular thing with gelatin for the knees. I think there's an infomercial or some multi-level company marketing it. That gelatin, where do you think gelatin comes from? Gelatin comes from several sources, but one source historically, and we can thank Mary Lincoln for this, who lived up in Boston, and she owned the Lincoln Cooking School up there, and one of her prize students was a woman named Frances Farmer. And Farmer took over the school, and they had enormous interest in how unique you can make food. But they're right there in Boston Harbor. So even the poor people had plenty of fish they could have. They wouldn't have lobster, but they could have the fish that was everyone's appetizer, which was oysters with lemon juice on it. But Farmer was famous for doing a original gelatin dish, original Jell-O. And to make her meals more interesting, they brought in the one cookbook from France that was the most famous cookbook in France that showed how they made molds. And these original handmade molds that you would then fill, whether it was with a flour that you put it in the oven and then it would come out as a bread or a cake or a pie that would be unique. But they also did it with these Jell-Os. And she would take calves' hoofs and they boiled them. And you had to boil and drain, drain, till finally what was left over, you would, overnight, it would gel. And that was your gelatin, to which they would then add different ingredients, infuse that, and then put it into the molds, and then chill that. And that was a very popular dessert for the aristocracy. By the way, hers was the first school that I'm aware of in the United States to serve 12-course meals. There was certain etiquette. They were trying to mimic the aristocracy of Europe. And so in the mid to late 1800s, you had all the very wealthy families. And then the traders who work with these wealthy families, the Vanderbilts, the Goulds, the Swearingens, the Astors, the people who, the J.P. Morgans, Fisk, they were the titans. But then around them were all these people that would take their products and ship them overseas. So the shipping magnates, they weren't as powerful or as wealthy or as well-known, but they wanted to be in that circle. So it was a very big deal on how you would have, let's say, a dinner in Boston, in New York. And if you just went down Fifth Avenue, you'd have the Cooper Mansion up around 90th and Fifth Avenue. You'd have the Vanderbilt Mansion, the Fisk, the Frick Mansion, the Silver Baron. Go on down J.P. Morgan's. You had about 15 mansions up and down Fifth Avenue. And once a week or thereabouts, they would have a party. And the average American homemaker spent about 4 to 6 hours a day going out to get food, selecting the food, bringing it back and preparing the food. But then you had to dress up for dinner if you were in the upper middle class or aristocracy. You had to serve your meal within 2 hours, and you could not talk about politics. They wanted nothing that would disrupt good digestion. Yeah, this is part of what went on. And so give you an example. They would take the brains out of skulls of cattle and the eyeballs, and they would boil them, and then we'd puree them, and they'd fold them into these squares of rolled pastry, and then they would deep fry them, and that was considered a delicacy. They didn't have a lot of spices back then. In fact, one of the concepts of the New England boiled dinner was it was a very basic, plain-tasting dinner until the rich wanted spices. We didn't have the spices in the United States. So you'd want your spice like lavender and sweet basils and from France. And you want the Indian spices, coriander and turmeric, anise, fennel, and cardamom. And you want your Chinese spices. So all that they would then bring in, very expensive. So most people never had spicy food. Salt and pepper was the average spice. Most people had nothing more than that. And when Farmer took her manuscript, she wanted to do a new cookbook because the old one was, well, it wasn't very interesting. And she took it to Little Brown and Company, which was, you know, a very famous publisher, one of the big publishers at the time. I believe this is around 1895-96. They didn't want to publish it. They didn't think anybody would be interested in it. So they charged her. It was a subsidy press, what's called a vanity press. They charged her $3,000 in the mid-1890s. That'd be equivalent to over $30,000 today. But she scraped together the money. She was not a wealthy person. And she had the book published. Well, guess what became one of the biggest selling books in American history? The Fanny Farmer Cookbook. It was right up there in sales with Uncle Tom's Cabin and Ben-Hur. And she became the most famous chef until Julia Child in American history, doing extraordinarily ornate, intricate meals that took an enormous amount of time to do and artistry. And so a lot of the chefs today probably don't know who she was, because we're not a highly literate society or appreciate history. But that gelatin, you can go back and look at how they made gelatin then, and then everyone else began to make gelatin the same way. But do you really want something that comes out of a pig's foot? I don't think so. So we don't need it. We can use agar flakes, agar, which is a very light sea vegetable, and it does the same thing in gelling. So you can make natural agar jellies that are healthy, infuse them with a vitamin C, and give them super potent oxidative, antioxidative qualities. Now, that's the latest on health and healing, and that tells you also about how to do the oatmeal. So we're up to date on all that. We're going to take a little break and come right back. Please stay with us.
About a half past ten, there was the woman I thought I knew in the arms of another man. I kept my cool, I ain't no fool. Let me tell you what happened then. I packed some clothes and I walked out, and I ain't going back again. So take a letter, Maria, address it to my wife. Say I won't be coming home. Gotta start a new life. We'll take a letter, Maria, address it to my wife.
I'd like to welcome all of you. If you've just come across this program, nice to have you with us today. Every day from all over the world, people go to our website to look at the latest articles, calls to action, positive, empowering solutions to our problems. Because I believe if we only have energy to put in one dominant and dynamic area, put it where we can actually solve something rather than complain about something. And if you listened last night, wow. Was he ever terrific? One of the most interesting people in the United States, if not the world, and one of the most respected. And I'm going to play that program tomorrow for people on many of our stations who didn't know about it, and that is Lewis Lapham. And the topic from our Progressive Commentary Hour, which is the hard-hitting, most insightful hour I do each week, which hence is the most popular program, it was the deterioration of democracy in America, the loss of liberties, and how the nation's 25-year trajectory of folly brought us the presidency of Donald Trump or of Hillary Clinton. Either one, it still came from the same place. So for all of our local stations carrying this program, you'll have a chance to hear that tomorrow. But on our core PRN, I'll do a different program. Now, also, we have a couple new numbers for you to listen live because our audience has expanded to such a level that we've had to add a couple more because they kept getting filled up. Listening live over any portable listening device, over a cell phone or a regular telephone, please write this number down, 605-562-5119, 605-562-5119. To download any show from the archives, 701-719-9976, 701-719-9976. And I want to thank the people who've sent us old radio shows. Someone's just dropped off a whole box of Progressive Commentary Hours from the 1980s. Someone else recently sent over some programs in the 1970s. We thank you for that. And what we do is we archive everything. We have a quarter century archivist, Sharon Pride. And every single show we do, every article, it's all archived. But we might have missed something, so we appreciate when you share that with us. This is for Dr. Helen. Dr. Helen believes that America is exceptional. And she's very angry at any of us, myself included, for not supporting Hillary Clinton. When I tried to explain that Hillary Clinton represented not just herself, but an entire group of mindthink that are interested only in their self-interest, she poo-hooed it. So I suggested that she listen today. So this is for you. And I'm going to start with the idea that, gee whiz, have we ever been guilty of what we charged but couldn't prove at all Russia doing? We said Russia intervened in our election. That's why Hillary Clinton lost. And because they leaked all the WikiLeaks stuff from Podesta and other files. None of that is true. But here's what is true. The Carnegie Mellon University study between 1946 and the year 2000, the United States interfered in 81 national Democrat elections in other countries. 59% of our interventions using the CIA, State Department, Defense Department to unseat Democratic popularly elected candidates was successful. So we, the United States, intervened 81 different countries, and we were 59% successful. The U.S. intervention in Russia goes back to Woodrow Wilson's administration when he, and by the way, he made a mandate that included the Soviet Union in his maritime blockade of Germany in 1918. He sent 1,000 U.S. troops under General Graves to the Russian port of Vladivostok. Italy in 1948, the U.S. threw the entire kitchen sink into getting the Italian Democratic Party, legitimately elected, representing the people, defeated. And U.S. intervention in Syria actually goes back to 1949, when Syria became an independent republic under civilian rule. The CIA supported a coup by the Army Chief of Staff, Zain, to end civilian rule. Once in power, Zain, that's Z-A-I-M, conceded power to the United States for transport of oil and signed an armistice with Israel. In Iran in 1953, well-known CIA-led staged coup to oust Prime Minister Mossadegh, who decreed with policies to nationalize the country's oil, paid the countries what the oil was worth, so it wasn't stealing the oil, but then make sure that that the oil profits went to the people. The U.S. media declared Mossadegh as a dictator. He was not. He was a humanist, populist, intellectual person. And so the American media ganged up, and along with the British media, and he was overthrown because behind it all was British Petroleum. In Guatemala in 1954, the CIA was involved in deposing President Arbenz and installing a military dictatorship that protected the interests of United Fruit, and this was done by the Dulles brothers. One was Secretary of State, the other was head of the CIA. From 1955 to 1970, the CIA supported Tibetan insurgency to destabilize China's control over the country. The Dalai Lama has said publicly that the CIA supported the Tibetan independent movement not because the CIA cared about Tibetan independence, but as part of their worldwide efforts to destabilize all communist governments. Repeatedly, since 1959, the U.S. and CIA and the Pentagon have attempted to overthrow the Castro regime in Cuba. In 1963, we had Vietnam. The U.S.-backed coup by South Vietnamese military officers against President Diem, JFK supported the sham elections that allowed the Diem to win by 90% vote so the U.S. could tout the regime as being democratically elected and the will of the people. Then we had the Democratic Republic of the Congo, 1960 to 65. Patrice Lumumba was democratically elected as the country's first prime minister after gaining freedom from Belgian colonization. The CIA supporting Belgian business interests with hundreds of European mercenaries in support of Joseph Mobutu to seize power in a revolt. Mobutu was vicious. Many people were killed, but U.S. interests, corporate interests, were protected. In Iraq, from 1960 to 63, for a brief period, Qasem ruled as a dictator in Iraq. This was followed by the CIA special operation to stage a coup, which led to Qasem being executed and the U.S. supporting the Ba'athist Party, who came into power, and it was the CIA and our Defense Department that put Saddam Hussein in power. In Brazil in 1964, the democratically elected president, Goler, was overthrown in a U.S.-backed military coup led by President Johnson. In Chile, in 1970-73, the famous case of a democratically elected Marxist president, Salvador Allende, being overthrown by U.S.-backed Augusto Pinochet, which led to his tyrannical rule, murders of tens of thousands of people and disappearance, and they killed all of the Chilean intellectuals, unionists, opposition leaders that they could find. This was all done under the direct knowledge and support of Henry Kissinger, the man who Obama loves, Donald Trump loves, Hillary Clinton loves. Wow. Turkey, 1980, the U.S. created a CIA-backed Turkish-American Defense Council. It founded it was founded by Richard Perle to organize and stage a military coup. In Poland in 1980, the U.S. support based on CIA and intelligence of a solidarity movement. In Haiti in 1986, intelligence support for the repression and terrorist Duvalier clan after Baby Doc was ousted by the people and Aristide was elected. The U.S. has always been an enemy of liberation theology and its proponents in Latin America and the Caribbean. Nicaragua, 1990, U.S. support and CIA interference against Daniel Ortega. Czechoslovakia, 1990, U.S. involvement with Vaclav Havel's Velvet Revolution against the Communist Party in power. In Russia, 1996, Bill Clinton and Hillary Clinton gave ongoing support to keep Yeltsin in office against his opponents and keep the Russian economy flailing, including a $10 billion loan through the International Monetary Fund focused solely on privatization and trade liberalization that destroyed the Russian economy. That's the Clintons. Venezuela, 2002. Bush-backed coup by the aristocratic Venezuelan families against Hugo Chavez. The Gaza Strip, 2006 till today. Hamas won fair democratic elections, but the U.S. has continuously attempted to overthrow it. By the way, Hamas was originally a moderate and a very small Palestinian organization that was supported by the Israeli intelligence community to create a wedge of division between the PLO, the Palestinian Liberation Authority, and their plan backfired on him. Honduras, 2009. Hillary Clinton defended her stance on regime change in Honduras, forcing the socialist and populist-elected Manuel Zelaya into exile in a military coup. The UN condemned the regime change. Paraguay, 2012. U.S. meddled with conservative right-wing party to have democratically elected socialist Lugo impeached. Ukraine, Obama had admitted the U.S. brokered a deal with an anti-Russian parties, which were neo-fascist, to oust the democratically elected and pro-Russian president, Viktor Yanukovych. Now, real quick, those are just some. Here are other successful coups that the United States backed. Guatemala, 1954. British Guinea, 1953 to 64. Cambodia, 1955 to 70. Laos, 1958, 1959, 1960. Ecuador, 1960 to 63. The Dominican Republic, 1963. Bolivia, 1964, and again in 1971. Indonesia, 1965, Greece, 1967, Australia, 1973 to 75, Portugal, 74 to 76, Jamaica, 1976 to 1980, Chad, 1981 to 82, Grenada, 1983, Fiji Islands, 1987, Nicaragua, 1981 to 1990, that's your Contra War, Panama, 1989, Bulgaria, 1990, Yugoslavia, 1999 and 2000, Ecuador, 2000, Afghanistan, 2001 till today, Venezuela, 2002 till today, Iraq, 2003 till today, Haiti, 2004 to today, Libya, 2011 till today. And here are ones that we tried to destroy, democratically elected people. We did our best. We threw hundreds of millions of dollars. We got our good terrorists, the ones that behead you with a smile, and we got them into power, but they were not successful. Boo-hoo. Albania, 1949 to 53. East Germany, the 1950s. Costa Rica, the mid-1950s. Egypt, 1957. Indonesia, 57 to 58. France, yes, France, 1965. Costa Rica, 1970-71. Angola, 75 and 80. Zaire, 1975. South Yemen, 1982 to 84. But we've made up for that today because we've destroyed through our proxies such as Saudi Arabia, Kuwait, Qatar, all of Yemen. Suriname, 1982 to 84. Libya, 1980. Iraq, 1991. Samoa, 1993. Samoa, 1993 and 2007 till today. And Syria, 2012 till today. So just as a matter of historical fact, everything I've just told you is actually real news and not some warped opinion. But then that in itself does not show you the face or the dimensions of suffering that we, in our notion of exceptionalism, have wrought upon the world community. If you want to say we're exceptional in many of the individuals and their talents and skills and insights, I agree. If you want to say we're exceptional because we have people that care for one another, we have people who are responsible, who have moral and spiritual values, I agree also. If you want to say that we're exceptional because of our military might, our political prowess, and our doctrinaire notion of all-encompassing might, I disagree. But let me be more specific. A 2015 study concluded that the U.S. is directly responsible for killing over 20 million people in 37 nations since 1945. Now, when you think of the mass murderers, you think of Mao Zedong. You think of Joseph Stalin. You think of Adolf Hitler. Those are the three that top my list. But we have others. Now, if you look at genocide, you're thinking of a 500,000 people or more killed. That meant that just Bill and Hillary Clinton alone with Madeleine Albright committed genocide against 500,000 children because innocent children were deprived of clean water by intent. And what do I mean? I mean that Freedom of Information Act documents show that the Defense Department intentionally targeted civilian infrastructure, water power plants, treatment plants for water, and electrical grids that power that machinery so that you can actually have water that's clean. That is against the Geneva Convention. No one has been held accountable. I believe they should be held accountable for crimes against humanity. But then again, I believe most people in power would be also equally culpable, but it's still a genocide. Could you imagine someone, what would be different? Now, I realize the liberals are incapable of reason when it comes to already solidifying themselves at the genetic level, gloaming into Hillary and Bill's happy people personality, a feel-good moment. But imagine if we had an ad on television. Hi, I'm Bill. And I'm Hillary. And we love you and we care about you. And we need people that represent women and children. And here are the people that we have represented because we've impacted them. And then for the next probably month, 24/7, every moment, another parent comes on to say how their child died until you reach at least 500,000, though the actual number is closer to 675,000 people died, and then show pictures of the dead babies, and then showed all the people who've died because of our interventions in their countries, and then show the little corpses. Now, at the end of that period of time, I don't think she would have lost a single liberal vote. That's how warped we've become as a society. That's what happens when you get into that really strong matrix of cult-like belief, absolutism, absolute nihilistic belief. The truth will never sway my opinion. I'm bound by my ideology. Same on the right. So, let us be clear, the United States and its leaders, all of its leaders, including Jimmy Carter. I like the guy because of all that he's done since he left office. I could show you a lot of the countries I just mentioned. He was responsible for making sure that they were overthrown. But we still killed 20 million people. So how do you say that we're exceptional if we've killed 20 million people? 20 million people that were not a threat to us, did not deserve any punishment, and we killed them. We don't look as exceptional. We're not as special. We don't have the same construct, but we've got a hegemonic complex. Let me be more specific. Indirectly, we've killed 30 million people. The Korean War and the Vietnam War, 15 million deaths. Involvement in Afghan-Soviet War, 1.8 million. 2001, the Afghan War under Bush, 12,000 is an official counting. Angola, 750,000 deaths from 1977 on. Hungary, 1956. U.S. incites a revolt in Hungary through its Radio Free Europe that launches a doomed armed revolt uprising. The Soviets killing 37,000. We were behind that. In Laos, 1957 to 70, during almost every year, the CIA would support a coup to prevent the Laos from becoming democratic in their election process, and because they were going to go for leftist parties. The solution, indiscriminate bombing. 580,000 bombing missions between 1964 and 73, 20,000 deaths. That's, by the way, a very conservative figure. Haiti, 1959, 100,000 people killed by the U.S.-supported dictator Duvalier. Indonesia, 1965, U.S.-supported Suharto in military coup led to 500,000 to 1 million civilians killed for being accused of being communist, and later with East Timor, a total of about 3 million. Dominican Republic in 1965, President Johnson's invasion with U.S. Marines, 3,000 Dominicans killed. CIA Operation Phoenix massacred 20,000 suspects of the Viet Cong. Cambodia, by the U.S. overthrowing the Prince of Cambodia, we were causing the puppet Lon Nol to get into power. That gave rise to the Khmer Rouge, which was responsible for 2.5 million. of its own citizens being killed. Chile in the 1970s, 30,000 murdered. El Salvador, civil war, 1981 to 1992, 75,000 killed. And Chad in 1982, the CIA-supported dictator, Habré, murdered 40,000 people, tortured over 200,000. In the ongoing Iraq-Iran wars from 1980 to 1988, 268,000 Iranians killed. Colombia, since 1986, 20,000 killed. Israel-Palestinian, well, we've had over in that use of the primary weapons that we gave to Israel, you're looking at nearly 200,000 killed. In the 2000 Iraq War, conservative estimates are from Johns Hopkins, 654,000 killed, but more accurately would be about 1.3 million. And then you have the 1990s Somalia Civil War, 1 million deaths, 350,000 from starvation. In Clinton's first term, Iraq sanctions, 567,000 children. That was underage of five. We don't keep the statistics over that, so it's a whole lot more. 1992 to 95, the Bosnian War, 100,000 killed, 69% were civilians, unnecessary war. Rwanda, we allowed 800,000 Tutsis to be slaughtered. Some estimates, however, later came up that it was nearly 2 million. Hillary and Obama, 2009 Honduras, We don't know how many thousands were killed, but it was high. And they went after specific LGBT people down there. And did you hear anything by Hillary and Bill, who were later saying, we're for you, when they were being slaughtered? And that's also true, by the way, today in Saudi Arabia. In Libya, we know that 30,000 people were killed, 50,000 wounded. In 2013, we have 470,000 killed in Syria. In the Ukraine, 9,100 killed. In Yemen's war, over 10,000 killed. So here we have to look at a reality. We say we're for peace and democracy and freedom, and we say that we are exceptional. I guess we are if you take the fact that we have commodified and commercialized virtually all life, privatized everything that was used in common. We completely eliminate any history of our attacks and utilization of our treaties and power against Native Americans. We built this entire country on slave labor. Without slave labor, we wouldn't have been the dynamic force during the Industrial Revolution and pre-Industrial Revolution, and give no credit nor reparations for that. And we've been a sexist, racist nation. I grew up where there was still segregation, where the blacks had to live on what was called Sumner Street and went to Sumner High School. So maybe we should be a little more circumspect, a little humbler, the next time we start beating our chest, wrapping ourselves in some nationalistic pride, and making statements that are not based upon anything but illusion. I'm Gary Knoll. Those are my thoughts. I'm giving you an opportunity to respond. Call 888-874-4888. It's our talkback number, 888-874-4888. And here's someone who's speaking truth to power to Obama. This is Jimmy Dore of the Young Turks.
Democracy is hard work. In the United States, if 43% of eligible voters do not vote, then democracy is weakened.
Okay. I love that he wags his finger at the voters who, on purpose, his system suppresses the vote of. Because that's what he's doing. You know, when people don't vote. But how about when you're elected to bring change to America, and you literally do the exact same thing George Bush was doing? You were elected to change, and you took his defense secretary and put him in your cabinet and continued George Bush's policy unabated. We are still in Afghanistan, Iraq. Libya's still a mess. You did that. You've bombed so much in Syria, you ran out of it. The hard work of democracy. And maybe you wonder why those people don't show up to vote. Maybe because you're shifting their, sending their jobs overseas. Maybe because the candidate that you wanted them to vote for passed NAFTA at the same time she gutted welfare and exploded the prison population, and those people know it.
And they can't vote either, by the way. The ones that...
Oh, by the way, all those people that Bill Clinton put in prison with this prison bill, they can't vote. You took their vote away. So you did it to yourself, but he wags his finger at them. Oh, it's the electorate's fault. There was no way to vote against Goldman Sachs. There was no way to vote against more war. There was no way to vote against Big Pharma or those cracking heads in North Dakota. There was no way to do that, Barack. That's why half the country stayed home, you corporate sellout. And you pretend like you don't know that? You don't know that your legislation has crushed your own people? Do you know that half the people in your own country are poor or in poverty? And you wonder why they don't come out to vote? Because they don't have a... Because as Hillary Clinton is asking them to vote for her, they know she shipped their jobs to Mexico and undermined their unions. And when the teachers were getting their unions taken away in Wisconsin, you let it happen. You didn't put on that comfortable shoe. And when the Occupy Wall Street people were getting their heads cracked, you let Democratic mayors tell union cops to go crack their heads from coast to coast. You did that, Barack Obama. And you wonder why half the country doesn't vote? Because they know no matter what they do, you are going to turn your backs on them, which you did and you continue to. The world is burning right now. Right now, global capitalism is failing on a massive scale. Right now, France is getting ready to be taken over by a right-wing government. Greece has failed. Same thing in Italy. Right now, half your own country is poor. In the richest country the face of the earth has ever seen. You call that a winning system? What kind of a system makes half their country poor, and it's the richest country in the world, Barack? And what did you do to try to fix that? You didn't break up the banks. You didn't re-regulate them. You never had a jobs program, but you did bail out Wall Street. You did do $4 trillion in quantitative easing. How many jobs programs did you do? Jack, And you stand up there and wag your finger at the people who didn't vote? You're just as dumb as Peter Dow.
Now, wait a minute. Wait a minute, Jimmy. Let's not push it. Well, his legacy is all going to be undermined by the Trump administration anyway.
What is his legacy? His legacy is that he repealed habeas corpus and shored up the surveillance state. And the people who exposed war crimes inside of our government, what did he do? He put them in jail and tortured them. Private Manning. He tortured them. Tortured Private Manning. That's what Barack Obama did. Tortured him. Those journalists? You're afraid about, everybody's worried about, Trump is going to be threatening journalists. He's going to threaten journalists. Barack Obama has already used the Espionage Act 6 times to prosecute our best journalists in America, already trying to throw them in jail for revealing war crimes inside of our own government. He didn't prosecute the people who committed those war crimes, which is why Donnie Tiny Hands can say he's going to torture people more. Because Barack Obama, you didn't fulfill his responsibilities. He abdicated them, and he's throwing journalists in jail using the Espionage Act. You and your democracy's hard work. Yeah, it's hard work dismantling democracy, which is what Barack Obama did. And nobody knows about it because nobody reported it because half the left goes to sleep when Barack Obama's president.
Okay. There you have someone who had the courage to tell the truth, something rare. Now, one more comment that I think you should know. According to the Physicians for Social Responsibility, at the University of California in San Francisco, and as well as the Simon Fraser University in Canada, the U.S. military has killed 4 million Muslims since 1990. Let me repeat this. This is a matter of fact. 4 million Muslims, we, the United States and our military, have killed. If you have 40 people per extended family, aunts, uncles, nieces, nephews, grandchildren, and you kill 4 million, that means you're impacting 40 million people in a bad way. Now imagine that we have how many people we didn't kill, but we arrested, we tortured, we displaced them from their homes, we caused their air to be filled with depleted uranium. Wonder how that impacts you. And yet none of that is being discussed as if that makes a difference. I think it does make a difference. Big time. Let's say hello to Kevin from Queens. Hi, Kevin, your turn.
Hey, Gary, I love your show.
And
That clip that you just played. I just wanted to emphasize that it appears as if the Democrats profess one thing. They profess change. They profess progressive movement for the poor. But yet they come out to do worse than sometimes even the Republicans. And it appears even with the Hillary Clinton-Donald Trump situation, where a lot of people are disappointed that Hillary didn't get in because they're saying she's the better of the two evil. But that's not necessarily true, where there's a profession of one thing, but yet is really behind closed doors or something else that's going on, such as the repression of freedom. And even in terms of some of the religious or even a lot of movements that the Democrats are pushing may not reflect the populace or what people really want, but is being pushed on them as a progressive idea when it's not really progressive.
Okay, let me focus on a few things you just said, Kevin. And first of all, thank you for coming in and sharing your thoughts. Can you name me the last leader of a party that actually went into a neighborhood and spent quality time there, where you live with the people, you ate the food they were eating, you went to the schools they were going to, you walked the streets to see if they were safe or not, and you spoke with them without being rushed and without a photo op, where you were getting a sound bite to make it look like you're for the people? Can you name me such a person?
Great question. I could only think of maybe I heard of Fidel Castro coming to the Bronx, one of the poorest neighborhood in
and
America.
Hugo Chavez, and yes. Yeah, but yes, you cannot mention because they don't. And also, have you known any of these people to ever send their children, like Bill and Hillary, sending Chelsea Clinton to a public school?
Not at all.
The very people they want to support them, to give them their trust, they don't trust those people enough to put their kid with other kids. So if you don't trust your kid being around other kids, but you want those people to trust you, that's blatant use and hypocrisy. When was the last time you saw the Clintons, I'm using the Clinton, or Obama, when before he was president, going out and putting yourself in the harm's way where you could be actually arrested for protesting?
I mean, they claim that when he was in Chicago, that he did a lot of door-to-door visits.
That's a lie.
I don't know how true that is.
That is not. That was a manufactured story. I've got the whole background on him before, and it was all manufactured. That was fake news making him look like something he wasn't. But then look at the people that he could pardon right now. Name me three people who should not be in prison, including a major Indian leader who was falsely accused. We have evidence he was falsely accused by the FBI, and he's been rotting in jail ever since. And it would take nothing but one simple stroke of a pen to release him. What's his name?
Leonard Peltier.
Leonard Peltier, correctly. And there's a man who was, all the circumstantial evidence, as well as prima facie evidence, shows that minimally he should have a new trial. And he's rotting away in a prison. I don't know where the prison is now, but it was in Pennsylvania. An African-American man, and what is his name?
Mumia.
Yes, Mumia.
Yes.
We have thousands of people who could be freed, and it would cost this man no political capital. But when a person has no downside to doing the right thing and chooses to do the wrong thing, that tells me about that person's character. When a person doesn't sacrifice anything for others, but only looks at how they can use power for themselves and their friends and business they're associated with, that shows that they're the wrong people to maintain power. And I'm saying this. I'm saying that both the left and the right that have been corporatized, not the ones who are truly idealistic, I have a lot I can share in common with a good liberal and a good conservative. I have nothing I can share in common with a corporatized, ideologue-bounded individual, and that's where we're faced today. That's why we're suggesting third parties breaking away from these completely indomitable apparatuses and going towards things we can change day to day for ourselves. I'm sorry we're out of time. For all the rest of you, for John, Wesley, and Robert, we'll get you on another show. We're out of time. Thank you very much, however, for calling in today. I'm Gary Nall. Have a nice day, everyone.